Welcome to the Ghostly Gallery Podcast. It's a place where we explore the world of horror in film, television, books, and popular culture. Well, greetings, everyone. Welcome to the show. My name is Bruce Markison. As always, I'm joined by co-host and producer, Tracy Asteria. Tracy, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic, Bruce. I'm looking forward to today's conversation very much so. How is everything with you?
Well, doing well. Normally, we begin with relatively trivial banter about weather and other things, sometimes less trivial. But today, we're going to get right to our guest. We're both very excited to have with us our featured guest, a standout actor, Richard Sammell. Richard has starred in over 130 film and television projects. He has worked with directors like Quentin Tarantino on the 2009 film Inglourious Basterds, and also worked with Guillermo del Toro in an outstanding TV series. Both Tracy and I are huge fans of it, The Strain, which ran from 2014 to 2017. And there, Richard Sammell took on the epic role of Thomas Eichhorst. We're going to talk a lot about that. By the way, Richard was nominated for a Saturn Award for that role, very deserving of that. A few of other Richard's works include Casino Royale, which came out in 2006. Also, another horror TV series, The Head, and he has numerous, multiple upcoming projects. Very glad to have with us Richard Sammell. Richard, welcome to the Ghostly Gallery. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Just came out from a wonderful afternoon with a lot of sun outdoors. And I'm so happy to be here. I feel so welcomed by you both. And I congratulate you for the quality of your podcast.
Well, we appreciate that very much. For those not aware, you were born in Germany. You grew up there. And I wanted to begin by asking about growing up in Germany and how old you were when you really first became interested in film. At what age did that become an interest for you?
Oh, film was so far away that it was actually an accident while I already was an actor for a couple of years. A film was such a big dream that I did not consider I would have access to it. Being born and then raised, I was born in Heidelberg, which is quite a big city, but I basically was raised 50, 60 kilometers further away. So really countryside, Bavarian, small villages, and the best you can get there when you stay there is become the owner of a gas station or the director of the local bank. So that's it. You know, that's the career you can dream of. So my studies, my artistic studies then took me away from that place into big cities because that's where the universities are. And from there, then it took off and I had an actor's career in theater starting in Germany. But then what I did there did not really please me. And then I got a scholarship in France, south of France. And then I started my career as a theater actor in France. And then I got a call from an Italian big director, theater director. So I went to Italy and stayed there for 10 years. It turned out that theater really was the good thing to do. And in my spare time in Italy, there was a thing I always heard about was method acting and actor studio and all those beautiful actors I admired. They mostly came either from Stella Adler or method acting or Meisner or you name it. And turned out that Susan Strasberg was doing an actor's studio class, a master class. So I took the audition and she took me on and I had a month class of method acting and she was fond of my work. And 2 months after that, I had the leading role in a first feature movie. It was kind of a dream thing, you know. And I didn't consider really to be in the movies because I thought it wouldn't fit me. And my passion at that time was theater, you know. So,
yeah.
And I guess it's a good thing when you start in that business to to have a certain distance to it. I mean, in my case, it turned out to be the right thing.
Susan Strasberg, that's a major name in the industry.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I was lucky. I mean, she was fond of my work, and I must say I had a real epiphany with that work. You know, I come from a theater where you all what you are taught and trained on is show you the exuberance of your skills. You show off or you show it, you know. And with the method acting, I discovered the beauty of what I am is actually enough. I already exist, and that's enough. I mean, I was so smashed by that discovery. The only thing is that you do not even need to show it. You just need to have something. So just be alive. And don't try to convince others that you are, because in normal life you don't either, you know. And this it was very complimentary for me. And from that day on, from that discovery on, I made my professional career between theater and movies. It was a creative, growing, ongoing process, and I'm still in it. You know, I do both. I mean, I do theater, I do feature movies, television. I worked as a dancer for a while because I'm very much fond of body work. You know, so I'm quite a kind of physical actor. So yeah. That was very late then. So it was 10 years after I have been already a professional theater actor that cinema opened its doors for me.
Oh, my goodness. When you were growing up, did you have any mentors or anybody that greatly influenced your life that inspired you to go into theater?
I had there also a very impactful moment. There was at my high school regularly every year a professional theater group that would pass by and would distribute the small roles in those plays they would offer to some of us who would dare to take it on, you know. And I was one of those. So I played Brecht and Schiller and Goethe, those German authors, in small roles. And I had a real epiphany with a real big moment where I remember that it was the Caucasian Circle from Bertolt Brecht. It's a Brecht piece, and I needed to play a drunken soldier who decapitated his enemy, and then proud and drunken, he would exhibit that head in front of the audience and full of my hubris of being the winner, you know, having a monologue and so. And all my comrades and also the teachers were so impressed by it. And that was kind of the first time I had a thing that something emotionally very important was going on there for me. Some high-tune, emotional, transformational, transcendental thing. And ever since, I was chasing that, and that brought me into the business.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, wow. That's a huge moment. Thank you for sharing that story. I'm a huge fan of the TV series, The Strain.
Cool.
It's phenomenal.
Please don't do me then.
I did not know that the TV series actually existed right going off, because I was such a fan of Del Toro's books that he wrote with Chuck Hogan. So, you know, it's one of those, believe it or not, I classify it as one of my comfort series that I like to watch kind of over and over again. So what was it like bringing the role of Thomas Eichhorst to life? Like, what was that experience for you?
Well, it was, there again, one of the most important professional experiences in my life is without any doubt not only the result, but the way we proceeded in this specific case. I got a call from my agent that Guillermo del Toro would offer me this part, and it was true. It was clear from the very beginning that this is an important part of one of the lead characters, so I thought. And I said, yes, but you know, you have to sign for 7 years. I really would love to have a discussion with Guillermo, what he's looking for. Am I the right guy? So I was kind of full of doubts, as much as I was enthusiastic about it. So we started having calls, and I would just kill him with questions and questions and questions. So these monsters, how are they? And my doubts about, you know, I have played a lot of bad guys, and what I really hate is to be just, we call it the one who brings the soup to the others. So, you know, not an actor who actually has something to defend and to play out, but he makes the bad guy in order so that the hero can shine. And I was, since I discovered that work with Susan Strasberg and Francesca Di Savio and John Strasberg, so I did a lot of method acting, I discovered how important truthfulness is, you know. You need to find an entrance into the character that you become its best lawyer. And that entrance, sometimes specifically for bad guys, is tricky to find. Psychopath or weird characters or whatever, because either you are brutal and nobody understands why, then you bring the soup to the hero, I mean, so that he can shine. But nobody gives a shit about your motivations, you know? But I give a lot of shit about the motivations of my characters, so I needed to know how they work in terms of organic and how they reproduce and how they eat and how they defecate and how they fuck. And I knew that I was in good company, because what I loved with Guillermo's work was that all those monsters, I mean, he's a monster nerd, but what I got more out of it, that those monsters, those creatures, I'd rather say, were like his babies, his kids. He treated them like his kids. He loved them. He had a real affection for them, and I wanted to get that affection for my character. So I needed to know. I was so eager about it that I killed him with my questionings. And later on, when I was booked and we had kind of the first season behind us, I found, he never told me, neither did Carlton Cuse, but I tumbled on a Comic-Con in Texas where I wasn't able to go, and there was this discussion about the different characters, and Guillermo del Toro and Carlton Cuse discussed how they took me on. And they said, so there was this German guy, we heard about him, so we gave him a call. And then I had a couple of calls with him, said Guillermo, and he just killed me with his questions, and he wanted to know everything, and he was so passionate about it that we knew we had the right guy. So at that point, I knew that when they offered me the job, it was not actually an offer; it was kind of a casting. And then, because I went so immensely into the work, and I wanted to know where can have a hold on it, and then from there it developed, of course, that was the reason why I was taken on. And then the very first scene I had with Citrakian, at the time it was a very strange day, because I don't know but you might know it, Tracy, that Citrakian first was performed by John Hurt.
Oh, really?
Nobody knows. You know, Bruce?
No, did not know that.
John Hurt played Citrakian. but was not very well. And the very first day I had my first day of shooting with him, I saw John Hurt passing by and I wanted to greet him, and he didn't even notice me. So he was kind of in a troubled mood. And that was the very day he left the set.
Oh my goodness.
It was also, perhaps it was two different days. Anyhow, on that set, specific set, it was the prison scene where is the window, you know, he's in prison and I present myself to the policeman as his lawyer. And then we have this thing at the through the window shield and we talk through phone like you do when you get a visit. And so at that day, I also had my first scene with Sitragin and it turned out to be David Bradley. So I had John Berg and David Bradley at the same time. And that was the day I got to know that it's going to be David Bradley. And we didn't have any prep time in terms of togetherness. Each of us prepared the thing for himself. You know, we didn't run the lines together or whatever. We didn't. I can't even remember that we were presented to each other. They were in deep trouble because of the changing, because John Hurt left because he was ill, and he died a couple of months later.
Mm.
You know? Oh, so there was this thing, and there was just an immediate connection with David. It was just. There was just something going on. And that scene was the first thing we shot together. And I remember that I was so happy about it because we might talk about that later. I did specific things for the preparation of that character that made it very risky for me. I didn't know if it would work. It means, I mean, basically the economy of expression. It's a very radical economy of expression. A stillness in him, you know. And it turned out that it worked with him because he is this incredible actor who has so much experience. What he needs is something to feed on, and what I gave him was my eyes, and he immediately got it. And so we had this connection with our eyes, and that was the scene is about, you know. And I got a call from Carlton Cuse that they were very happy about the first results and that they're going to extend the importance of the character.
Oh, my goodness. You did such an amazing performance of that character. It was.
But I would also, I must say, you know, when that's one of those extraordinary things I have this happening since quite some time. When I get to work with Americans, they give you the feeling we hired you, and here when you get hired in Europe, it's more you're lucky that you got the job. I mean, you're lucky when they get a job with Hollywood too, but that's not the feeling they give you. What they give you is we hired you because you are the best for the job, and we are convinced that you're gonna stun us every day. So it puts a huge pressure on you because expectations are very high. But turns out that I adore this kind of pressure. Means for me, I translated it, they are actually people who think that I am better than I think of myself. Perhaps they see something I am unable to see. So let's try to be up to their expectations. And then I just work my ass off. It just gives me this extra drive. You know, when it's like when people love you, or it's like when people believe in you. It just enhances your capacities. It gives you more energy. And then there's also this thing. I hardly anywhere else had this feeling as much as in The Strain, that I was not only the actor who plays Eichhorst, I always was with the head of department of costumes, head of department of stunt coordinator, head of department of lights, makeup, whatever. And they treated me like head of department of the character of Eichhorst. So it was kind of nothing would be decided without my consent. And that gives you a huge importance. And it gives you a huge power, but it gives you also, it gives you the awareness that you better don't misuse that power or that responsibility given to you. Use it wisely. Use it when really necessary. Then put your authority on the front line. Otherwise, be a good soldier, be a team player, you know? And there was this kind of thing that just turned out to be the right thing at the right moment with the right people and the right character.
Oh my gosh. Oh, wow. The storyline that you had, I thought was amazing. And you truly played like one of my most favorite characters of that series. So thank you for your performance.
Thank you.
So you did touch a bit on the cast, and the entire cast was phenomenal. I think each actor and actress, they brought such believability to the storyline. What was that chemistry like on set for you?
Yeah, that was the other thing when you are projected into a kind of family of which members are completely unknown to you, and you find out the very first day. I mean, you know you're going to spend 4, 5, 6, 7 years perhaps together. And most of them are not from Toronto. So we're basically on our own. And hopefully we find each other interesting enough that we easily can hang out together in our spare time, you know. And yeah, that was right from the spot. There was, I mean, they just did an amazing job on the casting. Because we were a family from the very beginning. The only one who was a little bit outside was Corey, but he was a becoming father. And he has back and forth between his pregnant woman who was in New York. Yeah, she was in New York, so they live in New York. So he was back and forth. So but he was a good team player, you know. But all the others we also had way longer trips to do. I mean, even Kevin with LA, 6 hours, and all the Europeans, they had 6 hours to London, or like me, Paris. So you most of your time you stay in the base, which means Toronto, you know, and. I had a 1 hour flight, so it was easy for him to go back, you know. But yeah, this thing is magic. It reminds me of a saying I learned in. Actually, I didn't learn it. I actually invented it in theater. You do not need to love each other to make a good work, but it is better. Better you love each other. You do not need to. It's better if you want to if you want to be able to do good jobs, you know, because we love each other and generally work well together.
And so most of the shooting, was it all done in Toronto?
Yeah, most of the shooting were Toronto was the base. I actually learned then also that a lot of so-called American movies are shot in Toronto. Like lots of them are shot in Vancouver. It's not all. Like Hannibal was shot in Toronto. All Guillermo del Toro movies have been shot, Pacific Rim and all these things. The haunted house thing of Guillermo, Shape of Water was actually shot in the scenography of The Strain.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Yes, if you compare, you will see it at one the place where the tank is, is where the coffin of the master was at a certain point, and the pregnancy station of Eichhorst Machiavellic maternity facility is the police headquarters in the shape quarter.
Wow.
It's exactly, it's the same room actually, with the staircase going up and then the first floor, all the windows looking down to the big space.
Oh my gosh. Oh, that's neat.
So yeah. So most was shot in Toronto and then the surroundings in Ontario. And for every season, we condensed kind of 2-3 weeks shot in New York to get establishing shots and to have some scenes outdoors on the Harlem Bridge or whatever, Bronx or the Twin Manhattan downtown or whatever, you name it, Hudson River, so that it was easier to sell Toronto. It wasn't. It's not so difficult to sell Toronto for New York, anyhow. You see an end tower and you put a Statue of Liberty in one of those on one of those islands and you're done already, basically, you know. But in order to pop it up, they had 2-3 weeks shooting in New York, and that enabled them easily to sell Toronto for New York.
Richard, you mentioned some of these great cast members that you've worked with: David Bradley, Corey Stoll, Kevin Durand,
yes.
Also Ruta Gedmintas.
Yes.
I'm curious, have you remained friends? Have you remained in touch with any?
Yes, yes, we have. So we're that's the good thing about social media. So with Kevin, I'm ever since connected through Instagram, and we send us greetings, and when I'm in LA, I catch up with him. I was recently shooting in London 5 months, and I met Ruta. She's a double mother now. And so, yes, whenever we get a chance, we try to connect, you know. There is, it's kind of a thing, you know. This is a business where you meet so many extraordinary people, you can't be intimate friends with everybody. But the fact is that there is a natural selection anyhow, that you can catch up a contact left for years just where you have left it, and it reignites immediately. And I have a little bit the feeling with my comrades on the strain, because it was kind of a battlefield. It was very hard conditions, you know, just to make you remember that this was night shots during winter time in Ontario, and yeah. Vampires are supposed to be insensitive to cold, so that I did not even have what human. Those who play humans had the big stuff to cover themselves from the cold. No, I had my Ralph Lauren suit, and I had to face that it doesn't hurt at all, you know. So, and that's how you bond, you know. When you go through war and you survive, and that's how you become lifetime friends, you know.
Oh, that's amazing. And I can only imagine shooting in Toronto. I live in Nova Scotia, and it gets cold here in the winter. Like,
you very know cold. What it is? Spend some winter time in Ontario. You know what we're talking about.
Exactly. So again, there were so many special effects in that TV series. You had one of the first scenes that was pretty iconic is when you were doing, you know, transforming into a human from the Strigoi in the mirror. What was it like seeing yourself transformed like that into such a character?
That was actually a beautiful moment, because I hardly, I mean, I think not even once per season I got to see myself. Yeah, once per season, every 10 episodes, I got to see myself as the vampire that I am, that I really am, you know. for that scene, actually, we really expose it. Like we expose it in my breakfast, special breakfast room with a chained human whom I suck dry for breakfast, you know. Those scenes are, I actually got photos from those scenes and from those and videos from the makeup in order to remind myself who I really am, in order to get this animalistic thing that estranges you a little bit from human behavior, you know? And so first of all, this scene was really shot by Guillermo del Toro. So he came in and he took care of that thing, because officially he only directed the first episode, the very first. And then he was kind of the archangel who supervised it all and visaged, got to see all the rushes and stuff. But he moved in also as a firework whenever we were in trouble because something wouldn't work. He would move in and with two, three, bum, 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 zack, all of a sudden you had a magical scene. It was amazing. And for this specific thing, I was worried because you must know that quality needs time, and you have lots of work, and then you know how the system works. You have these directors coming in, and they have a certain amount of work to do in a certain amount of time and not go over budget. So the main focus is get it done.
Understandable.
That you collide with the particular care every once in a while. Things need a particular care if you want to pop it up. And I would say it's not so much an ego trip because at that point I already was really head of department. So I really got the picture of what the project is about. And the main character is actually the story we tell. It's not that character, or that character, or that character. Fact is that there are certain things who are really important, and that's, you can't just throw it like that, scene like that. And then Miles gave me a huge smile, and Miles Dale, the producer, I'm in contact with him. I had a lunch with him last year in Toronto. I went to Toronto visiting some friends, and we hang out together with him and his wife, and it was beautiful. And he gave me a big smile and he said, "Yeah, we'll take care. We'll do that with you." And so I was completely, yes, great.
Oh, my gosh.
I have to ask you about another special effect. You weren't in the scene, but it was season one. And it's when they're doing the autopsy. Corey Stoll and Sean Astin are doing the autopsy on, I believe it's a general. It's a military officer.
Yes.
Who they don't realize how extensive the transformation is. And they start pulling out the tongue.
Yes.
And it just keeps coming out. Now, I've been watching horror for most of my 59 years, at least from an age when I was allowed to watch this sort of thing. So I'm kind of desensitized to this, but that scene almost made me lose it completely. Do you remember that scene?
Of course I remember that scene. I have no idea how many hours I spent discussing on the biological transformation from a human to a vampire just because of that incredible tongue. Because you have...
I mean, it was like 8 feet long. It was unbelievable.
Yes, but you have to connect it with another scene. You remember the character of Bolivar, the rock star?
Yeah.
Yes. And at a certain point, he starts to transform, and people do not realize it because he's already in his gore outfit. And so he, at a certain point, goes to the toilet and his genitals fall off.
Yes. That's right.
They just fall off. And that's actually the first part of the transformation. Your genitals retrocede and then fall off like a dead flesh. And it all builds up again inside, but it desexualizes. And it becomes a prolongation of the mouth, basically. It's interesting because it has a huge sexual symbolic effect. It has also integrated the threat of alien, where I guess it was the first time we see a big skull opening with the teeth, and then a smaller mouth coming out again with teeth. And there was already this extension thing going on, but here it was due to actual transformation of a human into a vampire with no very visible changes, if not that hair falls out and then the skin is disgusting, you know.
Yeah.
So I guess the surprise there, if there would have been aliens anyhow, and a thing like that would come out, the surprise wouldn't have been as big as in this case, you know. But yeah. That was a huge moment for me. But I knew that it would come out because I knew at that point how we are made, and
If they had ever needed an alternate title for the show, they could have called it The Tongue.
The Tongue, yes.
It would have been just as accurate.
Oh, homage to The Thing.
Yes, that's right. For those who haven't seen the show, and we all highly recommend it, it did run for four seasons, 2014 to 2017. I believe it was originally on the FX channel, but it can now be seen on Hulu. So if you've got Hulu and you have some time to watch it, it's terrific. It holds the story and it holds the audience for four seasons, quality seasons. And obviously, Richard is a huge part of it with his dastardly character of Thomas Eichhorst. Richard, I do want to talk about some of your other work as well. 2020, you did a show called The Head, which I have to admit I have not yet seen, although I've heard good things about it. I believe it's about global warming. It's got horror elements to it. Tell us about your role in that show, The Head.
Well, I don't think it's about global warming. It's a scientific station in the Antarctic, where you have the daylight working month. You have one team, and then you have the long night of 6 months, where you have another team moving in and relaying with the other scientists. So we're all scientists or engineers or a cook or whatever. So you have a group of 10 people who are staying there. It's a minimum reduced team in order to make that station survive and to do some research and some lab work and just keeping the thing alive. So we relay the sun team. They all move away, and then we are closed in that laboratory in the midst of the ice. And then a murder happens. And the first thing you see is a dead head. A severed head. Lying, and then you find out that it's the communication guy trying to, and of course, nobody else being there, it must be one of us. And then it's basically, I don't know if you have that in America, there is this rhyme thing, there are 10 people, blah, 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 and then one fell off, and that's only nine. And then nine people, blah, 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 and then one dies, and then it's only eight. And it goes on like that, with the climax getting closer to the more dead people there are, the more suspicious are the survivors, you know, because in numbers they are reduced. And there are elements also that there might be outside forces having done that. So it plays a lot with all the tensions and fears and expectations you have in a claustrophobic space out of which you can't escape, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's the thing. And it turned out to be way, way better than I feared it would be, because my biggest concern were the shooting conditions. So me, at that point, being a real fan of method acting, you see, you think, yeah, you do this thing in the big ice. Of course, you go to Iceland or you go to some place where you have enough snow so that you're covered from that side. Fuck no. We went to Tenerife in the Canary Islands, where they shot Robinson Christopher Columbus in the midst of the rainforest and blah, blah, blah. In studio, we had fake snow. We sweat our asses off. It was in July, August. I mean, temperature hit records. And I mean, you know, so it was all fake. And we had to fake the cold while we were dying of too high temperatures, you know.
Yeah.
So, of course, inside station, it was studio. And then, of course, here you're okay. But actually, a lot of stuff happens outside, you know, the garages, and then lots of killing happen outside. Or when you try to repair a thing, you have to go outside. And when you want to be alone with the love scene, you go outside. So there were actually a lot of stuff happening outside. And we had different studios, and they were not there was no air condition. So instead of hot boiling heat pads, we had these batteries of ice cold stuff that were coming from the freezer. And we had them, like, you know, all this ammunition thing normally from the soldiers. We had these ice pads on our bodies inside our parkas, you know, American Goose thing. And we were changing four times our clothing because they were just sweat, full of sweated water, you know. It was, so that was the condition, hopefully then, but no, let's say, what was really good is that the suffering of the sweat credited the would be credited to the suffering of the cold. It read like that in the end thing. And then a huge compliment to the special effects, because when you start, see, the opening scene is kind of amazing, just because have you seen the trailer, Bruce?
I have not.
So you just have a look at the trailer, and it's all a special effect. All the establishing shots from when he close in with the helicopter or the planes, and it looks amazing, very, very believable. So I said, oh, we are on the good side here, and it had quite some success, because they're now shooting ever since. They've done season two, and now they're actually shooting season three. And so it means it goes on. And when it goes on, generally, it's because it's good. Oh, it makes money, and people who watch it want to watch more. So good sign.
And here, a very different character for you. Sounds like you're one of the innocent victims, or potentially an innocent victim. So this is other end of the spectrum from the strain.
Yeah, I mean, it's not very difficult to be on another spectrum, because I haven't played very many vampires, you know. When you play a vampire and you play a taxi driver, or you play a barman, or you play a lawyer, or it's all very, very far away from a vampire who's 120 years old, you know. So here I was the head of the station of the night of the winter team, and then I had the love affair with one of the female staff, and it was a hidden love affair because officially she is with somebody else. And so it was these kind of complications. And yeah, but it was nice to shoot that because it had a quality. I mean, the suspense thing was more of a movie thing, but the fact that it was in one space connected me with my experience of a theater play, you know?
Hmm. One of the most famous films that you've done, not a horror film, a really terrific film from 2009, Inglourious Basterds. You have a memorable kind of a showdown scene with Brad Pitt where he's interrogating you. And there you had a chance to work for a pretty famous guy, Quentin Tarantino. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that experience.
I don't know. You pick out all those most iconic things that happened in my professional life. So I've told this a lot, but I try to make it short. I was going for the lead role, and I wasn't taken. Because Quentin was looking for an unknown but very solid German actor who speaks a lot of languages and who is not yet a huge star but very solid. So there were not so many who would be able to be considered. So I didn't get it. And as he justly said, so there is a dangerosity coming out of my pores that was not right for the character. Anyhow, he found the right guy, as we all know, because it's not by chance that Christoph got the Oscar. So anyhow, Quentin offered me that other character, and I said no, because I was too disappointed. I said, I can't take that because I have the impression to give me a lollipop if not to cry. I don't want a consolation. What I need is a motivation to do that character. Otherwise, I can't do it. And I wouldn't be fully there. And he said, okay, I understand. How much time do you need? I said, what? Yeah, how much time do you need to overcome your deception? I said, I don't know, 3 weeks. 3 weeks later, he called me back, brought me back to Berlin, and he spent half of a day only with me, explaining me in all detail the whole movie. And I actually knew all the text of Hans Landa. He knew all the text anyhow because he wrote it. So we were playing like two kids, cowboy and Indian, in his office on our knees and playing ba-da-da, and they'd make the big von Donnersmarck, and I played he played the female, and I played Landa, and then comes also to the scene, and then he said, you see, You need to be, he said, you are my Jimmy Van Cleef. You must do it. Please do it. So he was big and kind of, it was incredible how much effort and motivation he put into convincing me to do it. I mean, it was kind of completely unreal. There was this Oscarized, super potent, powerful, star who was trying to convince an unknown actor to do his part. And of course, I said, of course I do it, because I was so... And then later on, I discovered that he has done this for a lot of other actors who were... Because a lot of German stars are playing in that movie, and all of whom have little to play, so to say. He convinced them all. Hmm. I mean, some, I guess, just because, I don't know if all had these hesitations like I had. I was going for the big thing. I didn't get it. So I had kind of, the fact is that he understood the process of what I was going through, and that flabbergasted me. It was just astonishing. And then he said, you don't need a lead. You need one unforgettable scene in order that people remember you, and wait and see. Well, he gave it to me. Then, you know, I don't know if you know how much time normally you need to shoot a scene like that. In normal production terms, you would need 2 days to shoot a thing like that. We shot it 7 days. 7 days. We shot 6 days in a row, and then 2 months later, he brought me back for 1 day just to get you. You remember when I sit there very immobile and then the comes forward, pushes on my face. Just that for the whole day. Just for that, he brought me back. You know, it was
yeah.
No, it was a real, it's like, that's what I discovered, actually. The real stars are so good because when you work with them, you forget that they are stars. They are just enthusiastic, incredible artists who want to work and want to do a thing. Let's play. Let's do a thing. Let's do a thing we're all proud of. Let's make this. Let's, how, if we can do that and that and that. Oh, I have an idea. Oh, you have it. Oh, tell me your idea. So it becomes very, very boyish in a very positive sense, you know? And I remember that, you know, at that time I had guts enough already just to follow my guts. That's actually a recommendation I could give to anybody in this world. Follow your guts. And at a certain point, we were discussing a tricky thing, Brad Pitt, me, Eli Roth, Quentin, rehearsals, and it didn't work out when Eli came out and whatever. And there was so much fuss around us. And I was asking, couldn't we just have 5 minutes just for us? And Quentin realized, oh yeah, there was a little bit too much of stuff going around. I say, hey guys, please leave. In a second, 250 people left the whole set. And for the next 20 minutes, we were alone. And we just had a rehearsal, like in a theater play, you have a little rehearsal because you do a little scene. And then we figured it out. And then when it was done, all good. So very, very, very comprehensive, Quentin. Very sensitive, very tough, very, very right. I mean, I adore this guy. I mean, it's, what can I say?
Yeah. Well, the scene came out great. Yeah. It was worth the time.
Thanks.
Oh, my gosh. So do you have a preferred type of genre that you like to perform in? Like, do you prefer drama or horror or comedy? Like, is there something that just makes your heart really happy for performing?
What makes me happy when something extraordinary happens? And that's generally by accident or because you have enough guts to risk stuff. So I try to, and this becomes harder and harder because with experience, you get more cemented and surer in with your choices and you have structure and you apply recipes and stuff and you have to escape that, you know? You really have to escape that. So one of the paradigms I learned from, I worked a lot with a coach, she's dead now, peace to her soul, Geraldine Baron. She was one of the star students of Lee Strasberg, and she actually, when he died, took over as a teacher. She took over the Actors Studios at that time as a teacher. So she was also coaching Marilyn Monroe. She was big time. Big time. No, that was Susan Strasberg. No, Geraldine Baron coached a lot of younger actors. Anyhow, so she said one thing is to surprise the audience. Another thing is to surprise yourself. And I thought once you get beyond the fact that you're good enough to keep an audience in awe or to keep them in your hand, it's not so interesting to place your effects in order to surprise them. What's way more interesting is to surprise yourself. And that's actually, it's actually one of those things I applied really to the letter, and that's what made that's how I made my way through Eichhorst, because it was a very specific thing I needed to accomplish in order to get this to the point. And so just to answer your question shortly, I guess I get more offers as for very intense characters, because that's what's coming out of my energy. But I must say that I have I've grown up with comedy. I did a lot of commedia dell'arte, clown work and stuff. I did theater improvisational theater in the streets and on stage. And and now I'm going back to theater again. But it's all completely mixed up. It's, I guess I get more reduced to very strong characters and not so funny. But I must say that I miss a lot making people laugh. And that's why I'm actually now engaged in a theater production where I do a duo with a friend of mine, where we play a very famous theater play that had quite some success here in France, and we'll see how that works out. You know.
Oh wow! Oh gosh.
Genre, I know. I know that I want to escape the genre I've played the most in. So, for example, just to give you an example, I'm done with all Nazi characters. I started. With so 2017 was actually the magic year, because there was a very successful series in France, A French Village.
Mm-hmm.
That, by the way, came out also in the States. And there I play one of the main characters, and it's during the occupation in France with the Nazis and stuff. And at the same time, I shot The Strain, who has also a backstory of a Nazi, you know, a kind of a very convinced Nazi. And so 2017, that this was done. And from that moment on, I stopped saying yes. There was one exception, but this is a thing I could not refuse. But it was a teacher. He was a teacher at a radio, at a school where soldiers would learn how to use their radios, you know. So, but it was Sean Levy, you know, who made Stranger Things.
Oh, my goodness.
It's the series with Mark Ruffalo and huge, what's the Dr. House name? Hugh Laurie, no?
Oh, Hugh Laurie.
Hugh Laurie. And the series called All the Light You Cannot See. So I had just a small appearance, but it was so nice to he called me and he offered me that, I want to meet you, I want to work with you. So I had an officer's costume to be the teacher or anything. But with that exception, I do not do any Nazi stuff anymore, just in order to not finish like that, you know, because I could. There is so many things out there that got offered. I could buy houses with all they offered me, but I don't want to buy houses with money I earn as a Nazi, you know. So I think there is more out there for me. And actually now it turns out that it was right.
If you get any downtime in your personal life, is there something that you like to do, just kick back and relax and enjoy some time to yourself?
Oh, you have no idea how good I am in doing nothing. No, that's the other thing. You know, of course we are very busy, but that's the visible side of my life. And in the private part, you won't see me in clubs, you won't see me at the red carpet, you won't see me fighting drunken with guys. I avoid anything that could put me in any way on the paparazzi's in the paparazzi's interest. I am vegan, I am a yogi, I am meditating, I am lots in nature. I live a very private, very recluded life, because that's where I nourish myself. I guess that A couple of days ago, I saw this documentary about Danny DeLewis, who is known for being completely out of the picture. And every 5 or 6 years, he comes back and does Lincoln or whatever, and then gets an Oscar. And they ask him, why is it that you disappear and you don't accept more work? And he says, the only thing I can explain it, it's like in agriculture. You can't harvest from an acre if you want him to produce all the time. If you have a good, harvest, let the ground be in peace for a couple of years so that he can recover. And he said, because I don't have more to give, I don't want to give half or a 30%. I want to give it all. In order to be able to give it all, you have to have all. And that's up to you how you get to that point. And his way of doing that is to vanish for 3 years, making shoes in Italy or wine in Scotland or whatever, and then coming back when he thinks there is the right constellation for it, you know? And for me, it's a little bit like that. I am very busy, but only when I'm busy. But half of my time is the opposite. I have my kids, my friends. I'm climbing a lot. I do a lot of yoga. I'm reading a lot. I'm writing a lot. I take care of myself, you know. I'm not in the showbiz at all. I'm not part of any group of any. All my friends have nothing to do with the showbiz. Nothing.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful life advice, actually.
I don't know. It worked out for me.
Richard, we have just a couple more questions before we let you go. We talked earlier about your background growing up in Germany.
Yes.
I'm curious about some of the famous German directors known for their work in horror. F.W. Murnau, who, of course, gave us the original Nosferatu. Werner Herzog, who directed the remake Nosferatu the Vampire. Are you a particular fan of those directors and their work?
Murnau, I would have loved to have known him. And Werner Herzog is one of my favorite German actors just because he's one of those wild guns that he's kind of the German Tarantino in terms of daring, creating stuff that didn't exist. From him, I got this wonderful quote. It's in one of his books, you know. If you wait until you have the money in order to make the movie, you'll never make the movie. Just fucking start shooting. And that's how he did the thing in the Amazon, all his movies with Kinski in the Amazon. You know, it was suicide mission, but he just made it, he just started. And then out of necessity or the urgency of the situation, you'll find a solution. Just risk a bit more. I mean, we're here to try to do stuff that's, you know, that's why I love him so much. I mean, he is really, he's a very big icon for me, Werner Herzog. Exactly him, yes. I mean, then look at that. I mean, that's a real artist. I mean, if just three Werner Herzog things, try to put them together and you won't be able. You take Werner Herzog as the very composed Nosferatu movie with Kinski, okay? It's a beauty of a composed, very thought-through movie, you know, very balanced, and there is a concept, artistic concept. Then you take Arzire, the Anger of God, or I don't know the American title, one of those Amazonian movies with Kinski, one of those wild movies, and then you imagine him as the actor with one blind eye in a Mission Impossible movie, and was it Mission Impossible or what was it? He plays in a Mission Impossible with Tom Cruise as an actor.
Oh, yeah. Really? Hmm.
So very eclectic, very very versatile, very able to change genre or sides or interrogating himself about the necessity or the wish to make a movie It's one of those guys. I'm always ready to be surprised by him. And I love that about a director.
And just one more follow-up question for me is, I'm curious, you are multilingual, you're fluent in many languages. How difficult when you're performing, do you find it moving from different languages?
Oh, it's very easy when you get paid for. It's great motivation. Huge motivation. There is the thing called distanciation, it's kind of the thing you need when you have the identification so strong. You also need disidentification in order to be able to evaluate the quality of what you're doing. And that actually happens when you perform in another language. I'm not talking about the problems of finding your words in order to express what you want to express. I'm talking about the fact that it's like Samuel Beckett, he said his best writings he did while he was writing in French, because he needed some supplementary effort in order to be able to define what he really wanted to say, you know? And I guess what I love so much about I was a musician before I came an actor. I don't know if you know that. So languages for me are basically styles of music, different styles of music, you know? And if you switch to a style that you do not master so well, it's also a way of putting you out of your comfort zone. While you're still able, you're more fragile. And you sometimes say stuff you can't really say it like that. Like I'm sure I've done that here in that interview, but you find it charming. I'm sure it's not what I wanted to say, and you say, "Oh, you speak a really good English, but it's not the real English I'm speaking. I just try to express stuff I feel, and with the words I have at my disposition, I try to that the idea of it comes through, you know, and with your reactions, I see that I actually am able to pull it off in that sense, you know. So this discomfort, it's a creative discomfort that creates the change of language, and I like that.
Well, you are absolutely phenomenal.
Thank you.
This is amazing. This has been such a great conversation. So, what kind of projects do you have coming up? I noticed that you have several releases that are in post-production. Are you allowed to mention?
Well, there is one very big thing I am not allowed to talk about, but it is a dream that came true. And you're going to hear about it in 2025. Oh. It was delayed due to the strikes in the States, so post-production was a mess and stuff. So there's an NDA on it. And then I have a series we just are closing post-production now, editing now, and it's called Lex Africana. And it's a series produced by Canal Plus and Media Pro, which is a main actor in a series production in Europe. It's a story of a homecoming a black student who made his fortune in Asia as an architect, coming back for the funerals of his father, and then finding out there is something foul in his death. And he starts to investigate, and then he opens political intrigues, corruption, and all the things you can imagine. So it becomes a spy thriller family story, a modern story of how our life goes here in the industrialized countries. And the fact that it's no different in Africa or in Asia or wherever you go. So this is Lex Africana. And then I finished in November a TV series for Netflix, and it's called A Better Place. And it has a Ken Loach touch to it. And it's actually the fictionalized version of a social experiment that happened really in the Scandinavian states. They freed all the prisoners and supported them with mentors and apartment. Everybody got an apartment, a mentor, and a job, and in order to find out if that would re-socialize them easier, and that the percentage of the fall back into prison would then decrease, which actually it does. So, but society does not accept it, because society wants bad guys to be punished and not helped. Problem is, the punishment does not heal. Help does. And it's even cheaper. It's even cheaper to for the taxpayers to help them, give them apartments. But what the normal guy does not know is that keeping them in prisons also costs taxpayers money. But they only see that it costs when you give them. Why should he be recompensated? Why giving him an apartment when he has done a robbery or whatever, you know? So, and it's done in a very interesting way. What I loved about it is that there was not one character I wouldn't condemn, including mine. And there was not one character I would not defend at a certain point. Well done, I would say. And then two episodes later, what an asshole! So it's not. It's very, and you're very pulled. Where you put your judgment in that? Is it right? Is it not right? Because mostly it works, but for some it doesn't. So do you free also pedophiles who have done their, yes, but not in my street because I have kids? No, or whatever. What do you do? Or rapists? Or it's very, very tricky. It's a social dilemma. Well, the only thing we all agree about is that we have to change our penitentiary system, you know, because it doesn't work this way. So that's another thing. And what else? Then there is theater coming up. I'm preparing a theater performance. It's that's actually a nice thing. Just in two words, it's the first novel of Albert Camus, who's a Nobel Prize winning French author. He was a contemporary of Jean-Paul Sartre. And so we have the rights of his first novel. We adapted it to theater. I'm alone on stage for 2 hours. And we first bring it out in French, in Switzerland and France. Next year, we are going to perform that same thing in German. And then next year, in 2026, we're going to do it in England, an English version. And then we go to Italy. We're doing in the 27 in the Italian version. That's the idea.
Oh, my gosh. That's amazing.
So,
wow.
So I keep myself busy.
To say the least. Our guest has been the wonderful actor Richard Sammel, star of such shows as The Strain, The Head, but so many other great productions, both on television and in film. Richard, this has been great. We really appreciate you being with us and offering us so many tremendous insights over this past hour.
Thanks so much for dedicating your time to me and inviting me. I was very happy. I thought that you were really interested in my answers. That's actually really good. Good point.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure to have you. Our thanks to Richard. Our thanks also to Tracy Hysteria. Tracy, really the one who set this interview up and carried the ball for us. Great job, Tracy. Also producing our program as well. Thank you to all the listeners to the program. We thank all of you for joining us in this Museum of the Macabre, and we hope that you'll join us again next time right here in the Ghostly Gallery.